This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chris McCandless lived out a fantasy similar to one shared by many young people. At the age of 24, after graduating from Emory University, where he edited the student paper, he cut his ties with his family, gave away all his possessions, burned the cash in his wallet, changed his name to Alexander Supertramp, and hiked into the Alaskan wilderness. But the story ends different from the fantasy. McCandless died of starvation after eating a poisonous plant. When journalist John Krakauer told the story in Outside Magazine, it drew more mail than any previous article. Krakauer has expanded the article into a book called Into the Wild. Krakauer says he was haunted by the parallels to his own reckless adventures when he was in his 20s. 4 months after McCandless hiked into the wilderness, his decomposing body was found by moose hunters in an abandoned bus which McCandless was using for refuge in the Alaskan bush. McCandless had left an SOS note on the bus.
His writing was, you know, perfect. He wrote in these perfect block letters, and it was written on the back of a page torn from Taras Bulba by Nikolai Gogol. And the note reads, SOS, I need your help. I am injured, near death, and too weak to hike out of here. I am all alone. This is no joke. In the name of God, please remain to save me. I am out collecting berries close by and shall return this evening. Thank you, Chris McCandless. August. And that was one of the final things he ever wrote, perhaps the final thing.
But of course, when he was found, when that note was discovered, he wasn't out hunting for berries. He was dead, and his decomposed body was in the bus.
Right. I think what happened was he posted that note, went out foraging for berries, came back, and just left the note up. By that point, the poison that killed him, this plant that killed him, it poisons you very insidiously. It doesn't poison you outright. It prevents your body from essentially metabolizing whatever food you do eat. So there was some food he was getting, but it didn't really matter. Whatever he ate wasn't going to be digested. It wasn't going to do him any good. So he got weaker and weaker. And at some point, I mean, he couldn't even get out of bed. So he just left that note up, I think. The note was on the tape to the door. And he had this red knitted, like, leg warmers, kind of like big knee socks that he tied to the end of an alder stick as sort of a signal flag and propped that up out of the bus. So he was trying to attract attention. Maybe when he slipped in unconsciousness, he was hoping someone would see the note and come rushing in and take it seriously. But the hunters arrived, I think, something like 19 days after he died.
What were his biggest mistakes in the bush?
Well, he was good at everything he ever did, so he was supremely overconfident. That was probably his greatest mistake. You know, a lot of people have criticized McCandless, especially Alaskans. They say he didn't respect the land enough. He was too cocky. You know, he didn't give it the respect it deserves. He didn't take enough gear, enough equipment, enough food. You know, all he had was a 10-pound bag of rice and a .22 rifle and not much more. So in one sense, that was a mistake. But I don't see it quite the same way, because he was looking for a challenge. In his mind, any challenge in which the outcome is assured isn't a challenge at all. It's, you know, why do it if you know you're going to succeed? So he didn't have a map. It wasn't because he was too stupid. You know, he didn't think to bring a map. He intentionally left the map behind because, you know, he was looking for a blank spot on the map. And in this day and age, there are none. So he created one by leaving the map behind. Similarly, he didn't have a large caliber rifle. He didn't have much of all. It was just to sort of make the game more fair, you know, give the wilderness a fair shot. That's sort of how what he was up to. It wasn't so much that he was just stupid. He was overconfident. And you have to remember, he almost succeeded. If it hadn't been for this one mistake, eating a plant that he thought was edible and it turned out to be poisonous, it was the plant that he ate was not known to be poisonous before. It had never been documented to be poisonous. That's what did him in. And a lot of people might have made that same mistake had they been in that situation.
You say he didn't really keep much of a diary, that it was just little notes, like one word, two word notes. Mm-hmm. But he did write a note when he got to the bus that his body was eventually discovered in. And you describe it as a declaration of independence. And reading that note, I started to think, here's somebody who really wanted to be the hero of a great book. I mean, who wanted to have his life described in between the covers of a book. Let me read that note. And this is Chris McCandless's description of himself at that point. He says, 2 years, he walks the earth. No phone, no pool, no pets, no cigarettes. ultimate freedom, an extremist, an aesthetic voyager whose home is the road. Escape from Atlanta, Thou Shalt Not Return, Cause the West is the Best. And now, after two rambling years, comes the final and greatest adventure, the climactic battle to kill the false being within and victoriously conclude the spiritual pilgrimage. 10 days and nights of freight trains and hitchhiking bring him to the Great White North. No longer to be poisoned by civilization, he flees and walks alone upon the land to become lost in the wild. Signed, Alexander Supertramp, May 1992. It almost reads like if you wanted to be the hero of Kung Fu or something, you know, and the prologue to the TV series was about you wandering the earth and all of that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's self-mythologizing.
Oh, absolutely. It was very self-mythologizing and self-dramatizing. But, you know, when you're there, I've been in that position, and I sort of have done similarly vain declarations. So, I mean, you're so, you know, you have to remember, for 2 years he's been wandering around in the back of his mind. This Alaska quest is always there. He hitches to Alaska. He hikes in. He founds this really cool old bus that's this sort of manna from heaven. You know, in the middle of the bush is this bus. What the hell is it doing there? But it's there, and it's shelter, and he's just so jazzed, you know. He's like, yeah, it's working out, you know, my adventure's working out. So he just sort of starts with these lines from the, you know, King of the Road, Roger Miller song. And so, yeah, he was, you know, it's silly to look at it in a certain light. But another, you know, the guy was 24, and he was ecstatic. You know, he clearly, you know, referring himself to Alexander Supertramp and these allusions to Jack London, you know, you want to say, come on. But on the other hand, he was young and he was full of himself. And I can forgive that. I was like that. So that doesn't, you know, I can let him slide with that.
You found certain parallels between Chris's life and your own when you were in your 20s. When you were 23, you went to climb Devil's Thumb. What is Devil's Thumb?
It's a mountain most people have never heard of, nor should they have. It's a spectacular thumb of granite that rises out of this vast ice cap in Alaska, very near the coast. You can see it from the water. People on ferry boats and cruise ships going up the Inside Passage can see it. It's very distinctive. It's near the town of Petersburg. And at the time, this was back in 1977, its great north face, which rises more than 6,000 feet from the glacier to space, had never been climbed. Actually, it still hasn't been climbed, that face. So I decided that this was a worthy challenge, and I would go do it, and I would do it alone. It was crazy. I mean, it was way more crazy than McCandless's adventure.
Why was it even crazier?
It seemed more dangerous. The odds getting killed were greater. There were many hazards. Traveling on glaciers by yourself, you know, glaciers are crisscrossed with crevasses, these cracks as the glacier moves. These big cracks open up, and you can't see them often. They're covered with snow. So as you walk along, it's very common to just drop, you know, 200 feet into the bowels of the glacier. That's why you always rope up with another person so the other person can pull you out. But when you're alone, you don't have that luxury. So I got around that by buying a couple of curtain rods, 10-foot curtain rods, and making this cross and strapping it to my waist, hoping that if I, you know, went through a slot, the curtain rods would catch on the edge and hold me out and keep me out. And they did. In a number of occasions, they saved my bacon. But it was, you know, if they'd been a little bigger, they wouldn't have. It was not a smart thing to do, what I did. But I survived, you know. And it was, to this day, I'm really glad I did it. It's the most powerful experience I've ever had in my life. I mean, it really, at the time, I didn't think it changed me much, but over the years, I've looked back at it, and I sort of marvel that I did it, and I'm proud of myself for doing it and for surviving it. And you know, what can I say?
What was your motivation for doing it?
Just like Chris, you know, I had this. It's so hard to articulate because people, it doesn't make any sense. But I just had a sense of, if I just did a climb that was hard enough, that was good enough, that was challenging enough, and pulled it off, everything else would be okay. You know, how could it not? If you've done something that is the hardest thing you can think of and pull it off, on some level, it seems like you should be rewarded for that. Not monetarily, but just, you know, cosmically, psychically, you should feel good for the rest of your life. And of course, it doesn't work that way. But you don't know that when you're 23. And I think Chris had the same sense. I mean, he went into the bush for his last great adventure to kill the, whatever it was, the evil being within. You know, it was the same sense of, well, this is so hard, it's so difficult and challenging that if I pull it off, you know, I'm going to feel so good about myself that everything else will be okay.
What did your parents have to say about your adventure when you started out on it?
Well, I wasn't in much touch with my parents at the time. I mean, I wasn't as estranged from my family as Chris was from his. I mean, I remain in contact with my mom and my father less so. But they didn't really know what I was doing. I mean, I just said I'm going to Alaska to do this climb, and they worried every time I went to Alaska to do some climb. But they had no idea what I was doing. They worried about bears mostly when I went to Alaska, because grizzly bears are kind of scary. But there are no bears on these glaciers, or not once you get a few miles inland. So they you know, I came back alive and they were happy, but they didn't really appreciate what I was doing. They were so confused and baffled by me. I mean, I went to a good college. They did everything they could to set me up for a good career, and I just sort of turned my back on all that and became a climbing bum and a carpenter and got by on nothing and drove a $100 car. And, you know, I think I was a bit of an embarrassment to them, but I think I just made them sad. They wondered, you know, what had gone wrong? Why couldn't they knock some sense into my head and let me see that, you know, you had to do certain things in society to make it. But
had anyway. You written them off?
I don't think I ever consciously wrote them off. I was, you know, I had a sense of that my father and I were so at such odds. You know, we had such different values that I didn't see that we would ever reconcile. But I like my mom. She's a great lady. You know, I always liked seeing her when I was home. I am close to I have four siblings and I like them. So it wasn't quite like that. And I was so, you know, when you're 23 and you're like me or McCandless, you're so wrapped up in your own string. You know, you're narcissistic, you're selfish. You don't think about other people that much. You know, you are what's important. And that's, you know, hopefully you outgrow that. You just know, it never occurs to you that if you die, you're going to make a lot of people very sad. I mean, that's the last thing on your mind. So
you did finally climb the Devil's Thumb, although you took a route that was easier than the route you'd initially set out to do. When you achieved what you'd set out to achieve, you had accomplished something that was for you very important. What did you want from other people? What kind of acknowledgement did you want from them? Did you want them to say, here is a changed man? Here is a man who has been perfected spiritually and physically by the experience that he was just brave enough and daring enough to have?
I guess that's what I wanted, but I never thought it through well enough. I mean, my logic was very elliptical and hard to figure out. I mean, I never thought it through that clearly. If I had, I would have never gone. I mean, it was much more something from the gut. If I do this, everything's going to work out. You know, I got back and some people didn't believe I did it. Some said, sure, you did it. Who cares? And it was sort of a blow. I mean, some people said, hey, that's cool. But it's not like anyone said, yeah, you know, you're transformed. You're a hero or whatever. I mean, you know, people basically could care less. And that was sort of a blow. But when that passed, I realized that for a long time after that, it did satisfy me. And I was proud of myself. If other people weren't, I was proud of myself for sort of sticking it out. And it was a pretty miserable at times, and I could have gone back out and skied back out to the ocean and flagged down a boat, but I stuck it out, did the climb, and over the years, you know, I looked back and I said, yeah, all right, you know, if something's going bad at work, if some editor's on my case and deadlines are getting me down, it's like, you know, hell, I climbed the Devil's Thumb. I can handle this.
My guest is journalist John Krakauer. His new book is called Into the Wild. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist John Krakauer. I don't know if you have children or not, but let's say you had a son who was in his early 20s and said to you, Dad, you know, I'm leaving. In fact, I'm going to the wilderness and I'm going to perfect myself spiritually there and challenge myself physically and see what happens. Bye.
I would freak out. I've thought about this a lot because I don't have kids. I've got a whole herd of nieces and a nephew that I love very much, and they're entering adolescence, and I'm terrified, more terrified than their own parents, about what's going to happen to them. And I hope one of them has asked me to teach her to climb, and I've taken her out to a climbing gym once, and I sort of hope she loses interest because I wouldn't want my kid to climb or do anything like that. I'd be terrified. I mean, God, you know, the odds of them of them getting killed are just too great. I don't know what you do. I think part of the problem is you've got to let your kid do that stuff. The more you try to tell them they can't, the more they want to do it. That's how it was in my case. That's how it was in McCandless's case. I mean, Walt McCandless, he tried everything. Yeah, the father tried everything. He tried all kinds of things to talk Chris out of these crazy stunts. You know, he first tried yelling at him, and that didn't work. So then he realized he'd just play tennis with him, sit him down. Chris, you know, do you think about maybe just pulling back a little, or just a little, you know, or maybe just call us when you get back? And that infuriated Chris, you know, more than ever. He saw it as, you know, unreasonable meddling, and his father was being a tyrant, and how dare he tell him, you know. And that's the way kids are. It's like, you know, my father indoctrinated me from an early age that I was going to go to medical school and be a doctor, and like he was, and go to Harvard and all this stuff. And, you know, that was the worst thing he could have ever done. I think something to be said for reverse psychology. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I'll ever have kids. It's unlikely. Part of the reason I don't is I'm sort of terrified of the notion. I think I'm sort of worried about my genes. You know, I have this kind of wild and crazy chromosomes in there that I don't want to pass on to my kid. I wouldn't want to have a kid like me. So.
Well, I don't know if you mean that metaphorically, but you know, there was just a study that was done saying that there's a certain kind of thrill-seeking adventurer that has a gene on chromosome 11 that is with, I think they're calling it a novelty-seeking trait that this gene is responsible for. So you think you, if tested, would be found to have this gene?
I would be surprised if I didn't, and other genes that are probably less healthy as well.
John, you're what, 41 now?
Yeah, yeah.
Do high-risk activities still play a part in your life?
I'm afraid I have to admit that they do, although I leave a bigger margin for error. I still, every now and then, go do a serious – I still climb a lot, mostly reasonable climbs that befit a middle-aged man. But now and then, a couple of years ago, I climbed a really hard mountain in South America called Cerro Torre that was one time thought to be the hardest mountain in the world. It's not by the route I went up, but it was the hardest thing I'd ever done. It was much harder technically than the Devil's Thumb and much more dangerous, and I thought I was going to die a couple of times and wondered, what am I doing? I'm 41, you know, I'm married, I've got a wife I love. What the hell am I doing here? And went down after thinking that, and then, of course, a few days later when the weather got good, went back up again and climbed it. So I don't know. I mean, this is irrational stuff. This isn't – it doesn't make sense, this thrill-seeking. I mean, that's why I like writing about it. It's really complicated and really interesting. And, you know, you can't just explain it away. I think there's, you know, some people are just compelled to do this stuff. This gene we've been talking about might have something to do with it, or it might have just, you know, who knows? Who knows what? But it's there. And I think I'll be doing this stuff for a long time.
I realize this is probably none of our business, but do you think that maybe one of the reasons why you don't have kids is that it would be impossible to justify your taking physical risks if you had kids at home depending on you?
Yeah, I've thought about that. I have also thought, that's definitely crossed my mind. If you have a kid depending on you, you know, you need to be there for that kid. You can't afford to go off and kill yourself. It raises everything. I mean, it's not fair. It wouldn't be fair to my wife or my parents or my nieces if I died, but it'd be even worse for my kid. You know, I travel a lot just for my writing, and I feel like I'd feel bad about doing that if I had a kid. I'm sort of old-fashioned about child rearing, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm so ambivalent. I'd love to have kids, but I'm so terrified of kids. And I think, like my sisters who have kids, they just have none of that terror. It's just they just have this wonderful faith that everything's going to turn out all right. And I don't, you know, I'm sort of a pessimist, and that's mostly what keeps me from having kids. So I don't know, maybe I'll have kids. God, that would change everything.
So that's funny. They convince you everything would turn out all right with kids, but you're the one who has to convince them that everything's going to turn out when you go on, you know, a travel adventure. You couldn't be too much of a pessimist about that, or else you'd be staying home. I mean, if you really believe you'd die on each trip, you wouldn't be going.
No, I don't. I'm not that kind of pessimist. Although, you know, it used to be when I was young, I'd sort of get in this frame of mind that this climb is worth dying for. And that's very liberating. You think it's worth dying for. I'm not going to worry about it anymore. I might die. And that's very liberating because it's sort of, you're not as afraid anymore. You've accepted the fact that you might die. I don't do that anymore. I mean, no climb is worth dying for. And I certainly don't enter into any climb thinking that. It's hard to, I can't explain my weird pessimism. I have all these strange hoops I jump through to function in the world, and telling myself telling myself that it's, you know, going to be terrible and everything's going to go poorly is sort of what I have to do before I can jump through that hoop. And you know, I'm an odder person than I seem to my friends, I think. So now I'm confessing it.
I think I understand this particular oddness that you're mentioning.
Oh, you have that too?
Oh, a whole list of strange beliefs you have to have and peculiar rationalizations before going through with something that are utterly contradictory and people mock you for, but what can you do?
Right. Well, I'm glad someone understands.
Do young people in their 20s ever ask you for advice before, you know, packing their backpack and setting off for the wilderness?
Oh, not often. The young guys, to them, I'm a dinosaur. I mean, mm-hmm. they're doing all these hard sport climbs, and I'm just this old fart, you know, who's in the climbing gym kind of struggling up climbs that they can do. Uh-huh. And it's sort of fun. Like, I learned how to snowboard last year, and it's really fun. It's this young kid's sport, and it's you know, I skied my life, and I got sort of all my life, and I got bored with it, so I picked up snowboarding, which is this new challenge. And it's just fun. I mean, it's sort of – and the young kids look at me like, who the hell is that? You know, look at the weird clothes he's wearing. They have all this great baggy cotton stuff on, and I just look like – a 41-year-old geek. And it's sort of – I'm comfortable with that. I don't expect them to look up to me or like me or respect me. You know, I just – they're fun to be around, and it's fun to do stuff with them. And sometimes I'll go, hey, you know, not bad for an old man, and that – you feel pretty good. So – but, you know, no kids don't come to me looking for advice, which is probably all for the best.
Well, John Krakauer, thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Krakauer is a contributing editor to Outside Magazine. His new book is called Into the Wild. This is Fresh Air.